Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Nakwapi bhamo nakadapi bhamaha Nakwapi bhamo nakadapi bhamaha Bayantu sarvatra sadacha bhamaha Bayantu sarvatra sadacha bhamaha Kwa bhati dik kala kata Bina asman Dik kala lila Iha vapuhu vayam chet na kwa api bamaha na kadapi bamaha vayam tu sarvatra sada chabhamaha. She says, the word, it says kwa. Kwa means where. Kwa bhati dik kala tip kata. Kata means like the talking or the conversation or the story. So, kwa bhati, where does this kata, where does this conversation or any type of discussion or talking about time and space, dik means space in the four directions, and kala means time, where can there be any discussion or conversation or storyline around time and space? Vina asman, when we're not there, without us. So if you take the human being, if you take the upadi, if you take the jiva outside of time and space, if they're not there, in there, then where is there any discussion or any reality to the whole concept of time and space without somebody to be marking it, without somebody to be noticing it, to be putting themselves in the middle of a directional, you know, spatial context? So he says, without us, where is this kata? Where is the discussion? Where would there be a discussion between time and space? This word ba, when we use the word, we don't really use English in this way, but ba is looking at the presence or the experience of something from its own standpoint. Like, for instance, because there's light in this room, there's a light in this room, all of these things are appearing. They're all present to us because there's a light. If there wasn't a light there, all of these things would not be present to us. And so like that, without us, a conversation, the conversation between time and space would not be present. It wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be there. It wouldn't be showing itself, because there would be nobody to show itself to, for one thing. But let's go on and then we'll see what else he has to say. It says, Dik kala lila iha. He says, here, this play, lila means play, this play of space, dik and kala, this play of time and space, vapuhu, oh, let me see how I did this just a minute. Okay. So then he says, Vapahu vayam chet. If we, vayam means we, chet means if we are the vapuhu, if we are the body, if each one of us is the vapuhu, vapuhu is another word for deha. If each one of us, if we are the body, he says, dik kala lila iha, then here there is the play of time and space. So if I am the body, if I am this physical body, then for me, there is the play of time and space, right? If I'm the physical body, right? It says, and the first one is, where is there going to be time and space if we aren't here? Right? Without us, you know, where is there going to be time and space? Who's it going to be appearing to? And so then he says, Shade, if we are the physical body, then this lila, then here, this li, there is this lila, this play of time and space. But then he says, Nakwapi Bamaha, Nakadapi Bamaha. He says, Kwapi means, Nakwapi means nowhere do we shine. He's talking in the plural, so each one, talking in the plural, so including each one of us, right? So nowhere do we shine is the same as saying, nowhere do I shine. Nakadapi Bamaha, Nakadapi Bamaha, nor at any time do I shine. Nowhere do I appear. Nor at any time do I appear. Then he says, Vayam tu but we, sarvatra, everywhere, sada, cha, and at all times, bamaha. But nowhere do I appear, nor at any time do I appear, but always and at all times, I shine. Okay? So, that's a nice verse for unfolding. When we did the meditation, what I was trying to point out was in, trying to kind of unfold was in light of this verse. Even when you're sitting in contemplation and all types of vrittis, whatever they may be, thought modifications that come in different perceptions or thoughts in your mind, emotions, whatever is floating through, there's something to notice at that time. That's why meditation is so helpful, because it really, meditation, these especially guided meditations, kind of put the teaching in slow motion so you can actually sit in slow motion and see what's being unfolded. So in this meditation, what I was trying to make you see is that in spite of the coming and going of all of the varieties of perception, including the physical body or any type of sense perception or on different levels, emotions or imaginings or even the I thought, all of these things are taking place in your presence. But as these things are taking place, coming into awareness and going out of awareness, because you're aware of one thing and then you're aware of the next, that leaves the last thing, is now out of awareness. Right. And so things continue to come into awareness and go out of awareness, come into awareness and go out of awareness. But awareness is not coming into awareness and going out of awareness. Awareness, your being, I don't mean awareness as awareness of something, I just mean your simple presence. Your simple presence, your simple, we could say like this, your simple presence is, you are, your being is. But your being, as you're just sitting there recognizing these things coming and going, your being which is there is self-evident. That's what we mean by awareness. The very, your conscious being, the way to say it, conscious being, the conscious being that you are. It's not inert being. Existence or being, or I'd say the bottom line of your experience is not devoid of awareness. It is awareness. It's the awareness because of which everything is illumined, in fact. Not that awareness is a knower. It simply is awareness. Like the sun, you would say, as a fireball in the sky, is not lighting you up. Because of you, because of the sun, you are lit up. If you're outside, it's a bright day. Because of the sun, you are lit up. You are illumined. If the sun wasn't there and there were no luminaries around, then you would not be lit up. Your being lit up is because of the sun. But the sun isn't performing the act of lighting you up. It's not saying, oh, let me light up this person and that person. Or let me cast my light upon this swath of the earth. It is absolutely uninvolved in that. It's very swarupa, you know, is luminosity, we could say. And everything that comes into its wake enjoys that. being lit up because of the sun. So like that, every vritti, every thought modification, every feeling, every emotion, every perception, as it arises in awareness, and so therefore it is lit up. It's not that awareness is deciding to light up the vritti or to light up the thought. Whatever comes into its wake, I can say into its presence, enjoys the awareness. In fact, the awareness, your being, is not away from whatever rises up. You can't say that, you know, I, the awareful being, am here and the thought is over here, so there's some chasm or some sort of gap between your being and the different thoughts, moods, emotions, perceptions that rise up. There is no gap. But the thing is that these thoughts and perceptions, they rise and they sit. They come and they go. In you, who doesn't come and go at all. So now, for you who aren't doing anything, and in fact, you can get used to that just by, you could recognize, in fact, right now at this moment, if you can do that little viveka, where you recognize just your own simple presence, me. What is the most intimate? What is the most intimate presence is just your own me, your own self, your own being. You are not doing anything. All of the thoughts are coming and going with you, the feelings, the perceptions, but you are at your presence, the me. I like to call it the me because for some reason that me or I, me is more close. Just in, for the language for me, but your own presence is something that never wavers in any way, nor can you make it waver. And that presence, your presence, is not a concept. It's not theoretical. It's not an idea. We're trying to get the words to land on what they're actually pointing at, which is you. And that you that is present to every single thought, every single emotion, never wavers at all. Okay. Now, if you recognize that stable self that you can't change, then from the standpoint of you, the stable self that is changeless, where is time? Are you subject to time? Definitely your body is subject to time because you can mark change. And the body is subject to it. It goes from birth and it goes through birth and growing old and decaying and dying. It goes through all of this process. You know, it's definitely in a constant process of change. Your mind is in a constant process of change because you can mark. It's changing, and so you can mark time. Anytime that you're marking change, that's what time is. But if your being, your own presence that is there, like the sun, only the sun in that it's not doing anything except you are just being as you are, where is there a marking of time? You can mark thoughts, one thought to the next thought to the next thought. You can mark change in time in the world, one moment to the next moment to the next moment to the next moment. But for you, the conscious being that you are, is there a moment? Is there a moment? Because that means there was a prior moment. So there is no moment. You're the presence that illumines all moments. And so from your standpoint, there is no time. You have to take yourself to be the body for there to be time. Or you take yourself to be the mind for there to be time, because there is time in that level. You take yourself to be a transmigrated soul, there's time, right? And if you take yourself to be the body, there's space, because I'm here and not there. That's all very relevant, right? Mm-hmm. I'm here at this time and not there. Right? The time and space define us, really. We're held by and pervaded by time and space. And so all of our interactions assume time and space. And so this whole, they say the whole lila of time and space requires for me, the lila, the play of time and space, requires for me to be the body. Right? Body, you can talk subtle body also. The transmigrating subtle body or the physical body, you know. But you have to be some sort of a player within the realm of the creation, within the realm of change, within the realm of time and space. And so if I am a player, if I am a person within this realm of time and space, means this physical body or the subtle transmigrating body or the two together as we are now with our physical body, then definitely the conversation of time and space exists and it's meaningful. But is this conversation meaningful to me as the conscious being, you know, in whom all of this lila, all of this play takes place? From my own standpoint, the standpoint of conscious, the conscious being that I am, is there any such thing as time and space? Well, immediately, just based on the contemplation, when you recognize all of this change is taking place in me, but I'm not doing anything, I'm not changing, nor can I affect any change on myself, then I can say, all right, then from my standpoint of just awareness, there's no possibility of any change. And once you say that, there's no possibility of any time. If I can't change, there's no time, because there's nothing to mark the change. You see that? And so that actually, that viveka, that discrimination of your changelessness of your own being, and even you can attempt with your mind to try to do it, to try to make it change. You could maybe put a bag over it, just mentally put a bag over it and try to darken it, or try to turn your mind from it, or to try to divide your awareness in some way. It's not possible to do it. That's why it's fun even to attempt to do it, to attempt to make your world of perception, those things that are coming and going within awareness, to somehow influence or affect or change being in any way. And what you'll find over and over, no matter what type of exercises you do to attempt this, that it's impossible. And so it's a good meditation. Even trying to make the awareness not exist. You know, let me just imagine. You can see the fallacy in it. I am going to imagine non-existence. I'm going to imagine myself as non-existence. This is what Ramana did. You know? I mean, just imagine, if this is a young man, you know, he's sick or something and he was laying on his cot, and said, let me just imagine what it would like to be dead, to not exist. It's a wonderful imagination, because all that you're left with is existence. You can wipe out of your experience everything that is subject to change, but what is left is being itself, which is not subject to change. And so it itself is timeless. Your being, you are timeless. That, what that means, the ramifications of that understanding, is this very personal me that I am has always been. And not always been in like the flow of the river, you know, always been in terms of the timeless presence that I am. And that's why in the previous verse, I think Ramana talked about, you know, the flow of time, the past, present, and future. We talk about the flow of time in reference to the creation. The flow of time we talk about in reference to time. But when we talk about past, present, and future, we have to realize that, in fact, we have never experienced past, present, and future. When the past was being experienced, that was the present. When the present is being experienced, that is the present. When the future is being experienced, that is the present. You've never wavered in any way from the present. And in fact, as we looked at last week, that the present in samsara, within the world of time and change, you can't find anyway, because every moment is infinitely divisible. Let's say you look at time as linear. You can never chop it up, you know, small enough to not have time. And if you can't chop it up small enough to not have time to have like an infinite moment, you know, an infinite point, if you're unable to do that, you're unable to find the present. Because every division of a linear moment takes away the present and, again, creates the past and the future. And so here in samsara, in the world of time and change, we can't find the present. But we don't need to find the present, because I am the present. I am the present. I am the non-dual moment, the changeless moment in which the flow of time takes place within the realm of duality. But that realm of duality and the realm of time that I experience is really never anything but the present. Even if you bring your past memories to bear, those memories are taking place in the present. Okay? So there's no escape from the present, actually. Which is like saying, there is no escape from me, who am the present, who am the presence of the present, who am free. Totally free of time. Now, if I am free of time, and the body is not free of time, then can I be the body? Can I be the body? Can I be the mind? Can I be anything in the creation that is subject to time? Because everything in the creation being subject to time also is a process of change. It's all coming and going and coming and going and coming and going. It's coming into being and going out of being, we can say. And so this self that I experience, you can just have an experience right now, it's self-evident, you know. But if I just kind of relax myself and look and become alert to the situation, I am the stable presence in which the entire flow of change is taking place, in which the entire flow of change is taking place, the entire flow of experience is taking place, right? All of that is taking place in me, in my presence, in the awareness which I am. Okay. If we say that, like say if you're sitting and I just had to relax and kind of be aware of all of the outside sounds and maybe how your body was seated against your chair, or you know what type of thoughts were passing through the mind, all of the various levels and dimensions of experience that you were having. Were any of those experiences that you were having away from you? We don't usually think about this because we always think about my experience in reference to the body. Like say if I'm sitting here in this room, my experience is, now that I'm rooted with myself as the body, I'm 10 feet from the wall. I'm 4 feet from you. I'm 1 foot from the 2 feet from the table, right? And then the ceiling, I'm 6 feet from the ceiling, right? So I am situated in the room in reference to space, right? So I occupy a point in space, you occupy a point in space. In fact, we all and everything in this room occupies a different point in space. In fact, the hem of my sweater occupies a different point in space than the hem of my pants. It's just, it goes on infinitely. Everything has its own point in space, and every point in space has a relationship to every other point in space, right? I mean, that's an obvious thing. So say if I look at myself here, I have a relationship to everything in this room, a spatial relationship, right? And so space I mean, when we take all of that for granted, it would be very weird to, how would we even operate without having, you know, that spatial dimension and sense of direction? But now, what if I am not identified, do not identify my presence, my, the conscious being that I am, with this body? Then as much as this wall is in my awareness, would I say that? The wall is in my awareness. This body is also in my awareness. My thoughts are in my awareness. My emotions are in my awareness. My perceptions are in my awareness. I would even say, this room is in my awareness. This room is in my awareness. You are all in my awareness. This body is in my awareness. You know, my sense organs are in my awareness. My sense perceptions are in my awareness. There's not any possibility, in fact, for any perception or any experience that I'm having to not be in my awareness. And so that being the case, if I can see that in reference to me, my own presence, that there is nothing, in fact, that is not in my awareness, right? Then in terms of this room, just we'll take the room for now, in terms of this room, there's no place where I'm not, because there's nothing in my experience that is away from me. And so there's no place where I am not. Okay? On the other hand, there's no place where I am. See the paradox? There's no place where I'm not, because all the whole exists in me. But there's no place where I am as an object. Right? Would you say that, oh, I, the awareness, I, me, the awareness, am really existing here, my awareness is existing here on this chair in this body? Then I say, oh, my awareness, right, is located here. So now I'm looking at awareness from the standpoint of duality and saying, yes, my awareness, this pure timeless awareness, you know, is located here like a little pea in the pod of my body. Right? But is that true? Is that true? Is timeless awareness, in which everything comes and goes, right? Everything that can be objectified, your body can be known and objectified, your sense organs are objectified, your thoughts are objectified. Everything exists in, within duality, everything about you as a body, mind, sense organs, person, all of your memories, everything that makes you an individual, all of that you, that body, mind, sense organs complex, exists as part and parcel of the room. And the room, of course, is part and parcel of the universe. Right? And so now, all of this is objectified and taking place in the sun, the changeless being of yourself. Everything that changes is taking place and illumined and by that self which cannot be touched by the things that are coming and going. And so then they'll say, you have to take yourself back to that contemplation if you're getting a little bit lost. All of these things that can be objectified, because they can be objectified, all of them have their place in this creation. They all have their place. You have your place. Does the awareful being that you are, that is changeless, can it be objectified and given a place within duality? Right? Do you see what I mean? Like, can you take awareness and stick it into the room as an object? Like, here you are, and here you are, and here you are, and here's little Miss Awareness right here. Is it possible to take your being, the conscious being that you are, and place it in the room? So here, Ramana is saying, no, There's nowhere that you are. You're not a thing in the room. And at the same time, you are everywhere. There's nowhere that you are, but you are everywhere. An object can't be everywhere. So look at your experience from the vantage point of yourself as the awareful being that you are, your own presence, your own me. Is there any experience that you ever have, can ever have, and ever will have that will be away from you? Can you have an experience, any experience, these experiences that come and go, that is separate from or away from you? And you have to say no, because if it was separate from or away from you, you wouldn't be having it. Right? It wouldn't be lit by awareness. And so that means that you are the pervading presence, the self, the being, not just of this body, mind, sense organs, but you are the self and being of all experience. In fact, you are the very center, the very stable substance of all experience. And so now, we don't usually think like this because we're so busy identified with the body and just thinking in this spatial, within the confines of time and space, within the time-space conversation, right? From the standpoint of this body, of course we're engaged in that. And if I take myself to be this body, then I am engaged in this time-space conversation. It's pervasive to every part of my life. But what if I do this viveka, this discrimination, and I recognize, you know, actually, I'm not part of any conversation. I'm not part of any conversation. I am the self of every conversation. But I'm not part of any conversation to be separated, you know. And so I'm part of this conversation and not part of this conversation. I'm part of this side of the room but not part of this side of the room. I'm simply not a part. And there is no experience that I have that is ever separate from me. So both I am not coming and going, and that's something that you have what we call, you know, that now that recognition is what we call an aparoksha jnanam. Aparoksha jnanam is a fancy way of saying, you know, your self experience is self-evident. Whereas every other experience that you have is not self-evident. It depends on the mind or the sense organs for it to be known. It needs to be illumined. Every experience that you have, it must be illumined for it to be known. You do not need to be illumined to be known. You are luminosity itself. You do not need to be aware of an object that is being illumined. Everything else does, except for you. You don't need to be illumined because you're self-luminous. It's called swaprakashatvam, you're self-luminous. Awareness doesn't need another awareness to come in to light it up. That would be an infinite regress. Bring in an awareness to light up this awareness, and then, of course, we need another awareness to light up that awareness, and another awareness to light up that awareness, which is called infinite regress. So the buck stops somewhere. It stops where? It stops at awareness. And so then, what is the nature of awareness? Well, the nature of awareness is awareness, but awareness is. And awareness is. What does that mean? That's just another way of saying that awareness is being. If you say awareness, I'll listen to this language, the awareness that I am, the awareness that I am, is there an amness that's different from awareness? For me, I would say like this, It's a play of words, but you have to let the words kind of point to the situation. If you say, I exist, okay? I am, I exist. What is the nature of your amness, of your being? Okay? Now, just to try to really, I want you to try to just let my words be, because my words are actually not theoretical, they're actually trying to point to your own experience. If you say, I am, I exist, and say, now we contemplate, and we let everything relax just so that I can be, so that I can be aware of my own presence, my own being. Is your being something other than your awareness? Another way of saying it, is your amness inert? Is your being inert? And that's like saying, is awareness inert? Because I am an awareful being. So is your awareness non-existent? No, of course not. Is your amness inert? No, of course not. I am a conscious being. The conscious being that I am is free from time, is free from being objectified as an object in the world. So I am an awareful, a being which is awareness. My awareness is my being is my awareness. Awareness is being is awareness. I am and I am awareness. Okay. So now, that being that you are, which is awareness, is you are the very being, the very substratum into which all of the changing experiences, all of the changing experiences come and go. The changing experiences come into your being and go out of your being. When they come into your being, they are. When they go out of your being, they are not. Right? Any, say, that's just from your, the standpoint of your own being and your own experience. Things come into your being and then they are. They go out of your being, then they are not. But it's the same in the physical realm also. Anything that changes, its prior condition no longer is. Anything that changes, what it was before is no more. Anything. What it was before is no more. It's not like, you know, it files its prior condition away somewhere. You know, that would be amazing. Okay, so what does this say, though, is that being is, the being that is consciousness. The being that is you. And everything else enjoys that being when it is there. When it is not there, it doesn't enjoy the being. So the only thing that has been really is not going to be something that comes and goes. It's going to be the being in which things come and go. And that is you. So a few more minutes, just hang on. We'll be all right. The best drishtanta, the best illustration for understanding this, and they use the chapter 1 of the Mandukya Upanishad. You know, after the 12 major verses of the Upanishad are done, then Gaudapada writes a karika. It's a whole exposition on the Mandukya Upanishad in the form of verses. And the first chapter is all about the dream, using the dream illustration. You know, so in fact, traditionally when we're taught and we go through, you know, what all the major Upanishads were, actually usually 4 or 5 are taught, and then you study the others on your own, because it would take your lifetime to do all of them. But the last Upanishad that's usually taught after doing all of the, what they call the Prakarana Granthas, like Atma Bodh and Satdarshan and all of these explanatory texts and all of the Upanishads, finally they teach the Mandukya Upanishad, because they say, after you teach the Mandukya, then you don't want to learn anything else. I guess it's over. It's totally over. So it's the last one that's taught. Anyway, because it just destroys any type of duality, you know. So that's when you have to just say, okay, I'm the whole, and that's the that's the, you know, Advaita, totally, with the Mandukya. All of the Upanishads resolve there, but the Mandukya just goes there, right there, and just stays there. You know, it's all just Advaita, non-duality. But anyway, the drishtanta for the dream, swapna, right? Swapna, swapna, for the dream, is used as kind of the Achilles heel to the whole of duality. Because we actually have a drishtanta, an illustration that can make a person to show how non-duality is possible, how the satya-mitya relationship is possible, and how, in fact, you fall into that every night in dream. Right? But when we analyze the dream, you can see so clearly, your mind immediately accepts this phenomenon that this world of change, the universe of change, of duality, rises in me, is sustained by me, and resolves into me. The dream comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. But when the dream is there, when the dream is there, I am identified with a character within the dream. Sometimes, usually. I'm identified with a character within the dream. And when I'm identified with that character, I am experiencing the world in terms of time and space and quality. Right? Because I'm within the time-space confines of the dream universe. And all of my experience is from the standpoint of that dream character. I perceive with my sense organs. I move with my body. Everything is directional. Everything is taking place in time. That is my reality. But in fact, that reality is dependent. That reality is what we call vyavahara. It's Ishwara's reality, that the reality that takes place within time and space. There's an objective reality there. But that dream reality that has its own objective reality within the dream actually has for its being one conscious being, which is me. If I say, you know, I'm the self of the dream, I'm the consciousness which pervades the whole dream, I'm the being which is the self, the reality of the whole dream. The dream takes place in my being. The dream is known because of my awareness. I am the sat-chit. I am the sat-chit of the entire dream. And for me, there is no time. For me, I am the presence in which time is taking place. The time is what's going on in the dream, right? And I am the consciousness in which space takes place. There is no space that's away from me, but at the same time, I'm not an object in space. You can't find me anywhere in space, but space is not apart from me. I am the self of space. I am the self of the creation. But I'm not an object to be found in the creation. I'm the self of every object in the creation, of the creation as a whole. So here, let's go over this verse again. He says, without us, where is there any conversation about time and space? Only if I am the body, if each one of us, if we are the body, can there be this play of time and space? Body says, we are in reality, right? There is nowhere where we are, the Atma, nowhere where I am. I'm not an object here. And there's no time when I am. I was born here at this period of time. There's no time when I am. However, he says, but I am everywhere, Sarvatra, and I am there at all times because I'm the present. am the presence, the being in which all times take place, and I am the being in which the whole time-space continuum is. So there's no time when I am not, and there's no place when I am not, and yet I'm not an object, right? To be an object in space. And I don't take place in time, right? Because I'm not an object in the universe. Okay, so that's good for today. Let's just take a minute. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
This is very strange. I do experience myself. I have that as experience, my own being. But it's not an experience that's of an object and that's in time or space. But yet I still have the experience.
It is its own experience. So it's not a subject-object experience, but your own presence is self-evident. Your own being is self-evident. So when you say your own being is self-evident, then it's consciousness. Your own being is consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a good way to understand it is say when you contemplate, if you think of or do meditation, the steps involved in meditation involve just withdrawing. There's many different types of meditation, but one type of meditation is where you're just, you know, withdrawing in all of the sensory data, quietening the mind, you know. And as you do that, you are not dimming. Right? As you withdraw all of the sensory data and you quieten your mind and get rid of all of the, you are still shining very brightly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody illumining you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not like somebody's illumining you so that you can shine.
Yeah, there's no process.
And there's nothing happening. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's what we mean by self-luminous. It's kind of like you're the bottom line. Right? There's nobody behind you illumining you. You are your own, you are consciousness itself, being itself. And that being is very, very personal. It's not like when you, what I mean by very personal, that being is you, who you, even when you say, I am this body, the I am part that makes you you is what you're identifying as being this body. But in fact, what you're identifying as being this body is actually free. You are actually free. You're not subject to the birth and death and time of the body. But this body, it's not that the body is away from you, nor is any experience away from you, but you don't go along with the experience. Experiences come and go. But you, the very intimate you that makes you you, is absolutely stable and self-evident.
But we experience the body also. Isn't that not an experience?
It is an experience. The body is an experience, but it's objectifiable. You can be without the experience of the body, which even throughout the day when you're in the waking state, you know, how many times you're always checking in with the body, but how many times, you know, is it actually not something that you're focused on at all, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So many times, you know, let alone in something like deep sleep where the sense organs are not engaged in any type of relationship with the physical world, you know, and the mind is in an unmanifest condition. So the whole perception, you know, experience of the body and of the world really depends upon your mind and your sense organs. You know, it's a thing to understand what we call the whole satya mitya. What is really the truth of something, and then what depends upon that truth. What depends upon the truth of something is called what we call mitya. It is we said dependent reality. It depends where it's being on something else. So we use the clay pot example for that, where the pot depends totally on its being for the clay, not with the clay, right? Without the clay, there is no pot. But from the standpoint of the clay, there's only clay. It's not like there's a pot. There's not clay and a pot. There's only clay. You know, and whether that pot transforms into the shape of a plate, from the standpoint of clay, there's only clay. Right? But from the standpoint of the pot is fragile. The pot could break. It could become a plate. It could go back into a ball, you know. But we say the pot is fragile, acknowledging the pot. But from the standpoint of the clay, there's nothing there to acknowledge, you know. And so here, when you say, I am this body, it is true. It's like the pot saying, I am the clay. True. I am the clay. You say, I am this body. True. That the conscious being that you are is this body, but it also is the rug and it's everything, you know. But it is this body, and it is free of this body. That's what the person who doesn't have self-knowledge doesn't understand that. You think that this body is, in a sense, producing your being.
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as the body is, you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If the body dies, then I die.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you have a belief system that when I die, I go to heaven or something like that. But then that's another subtle body, a soul that's going up to heaven, something like that. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're saying that soul is just another, in my view, it's a subtle body. That's just another body. Who's the self of that body? Yeah. And so that's why you can make the so-called mistake to take yourself to be the body, or to take yourself to be the body-mind, because from the standpoint of the body-mind, this is a conscious being.
Mm-hmm.
The mind does enjoy consciousness. The sense organs do enjoy consciousness. It's just that there's no viveka for you to yet, until there is, to recognize that it's not the same from both sides. From the side of consciousness, there is no coming and going. There is the side of me, just me, the conscious being. There is no coming and going. There is no change. But from the side of the body and the mind, there is change and there is coming and going and there is birth and death and all of this. But all of that is never apart from me, the awareful being. And so, of course, the mind, because self-ignorance there is there, will say, I am the awareful being, because it's never away from the awareful being. But then it'll see there's such a thing as a dead body. So, you know, then the mind will say, and I'm only here as long as I'm the awareful being, and I'm only here as long as the body's alive, because when the body's dead, then I don't see any mind there, I just see a dead body. So it's all this, what we call superimposition, taking place. It all has to be unpacked and kind of differentiated.
Well, the mind will say also that when it dies, awareness dies. Mm-hmm. Very clear.
Well, why? Of course it will say that, because you see that body's dead. A dead body doesn't have any awareness. You know? So a live body has awareness, a dead body doesn't. And so if you think that the awareness is a product of this body, then you can say, yeah, this awareness is a product of this body and it will be here as long as the body's alive. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have to do so much teaching. That's what the Upanishads are all about, to make you really sit with your experience and differentiate, you know, what can be yourself from what can be objectified. Yourself from what comes and goes in your experience. There's a very powerful logic called Anvaya Vyatireka. And this logic goes like this. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. If that holds true, the anvaya is the positive. When this is, that is. The vyatireka is the negative. When this is not, that is not. That will tell you that this is dependent on that. Right? Because when this is, that is, and when this is gone, that is gone. So that there's a dependency there. The two dependent upon each other. But what if you're in a situation like this? When this is, that is. When this is not, that still is. What does that tell you? The anvaya, there's no relationship. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. So the anvaya, the positive, is there, but the vyatireka is not there. So when this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. When this is not, that still is. Then there's no relationship. So now you look at like this. When the sorrowful thought is, I am. I am sorrowful. When the sorrowful thought is, I am. When the sorrowful thought is not, I'm not. So you can say, you know, when the dream universe is, I am. When the dream is gone, I still am. But this anvaya vyatireka, different forms of it we use in so many different teaching methodologies, because it helps you to perform this viveka. Viveka means a discriminative analysis, where two things, viveka is necessary when two things are appearing to be one. They're appearing as one. Then you need to discriminate the one from the other. If two things are appearing to be one, but they're not one, you know, then we have to do that differentiation. You know? You say, no, this can be differentiated. Right? And this type of differentiation is very subtle, because in reality there aren't two things, there is only one. And so there really, in truth, is not a second thing to differentiate. But this, the order there, this, it comes down to order of reality is like this. You would say with a clay pot, really in truth there's only one. But we can account for the clay, right? We can account for the pot. But really there's nothing but clay there. Now, if I have to differentiate between the clay and the pot, and that's a little different than differentiating between the chair and the table. If you differentiate between the clay and the pot, it's a different type of differentiation, where the one is dependent on the other for its being, where the other is free. Whether it's from the standpoint of the clay, there's no dependence on the pot whatsoever. And from its standpoint, there's only clay there. But since we're in the realm of the pot, right, in this universe,
mm-hmm.
the pot has to be able to recognize itself, you know, as being, having for its reality clay, what it actually is, like the pot would say, you know, I'm actually clay. And and even if this pot form turns into a plate, I still am. Nothing happens to me. You know? So it has to be able to understand that. And that requires differentiation. And it's not that easy because the truth of your body and the universe for that matter is the awareful being which you are. And so there's no distance between awareness in the body or awareness in the mind. You know, and so if the mind reflects awareness more than the table does, why won't it say, I am the awareful being?
Right.
Because there's a natural ignorance there. That's why the mind needs a teacher. That's why this whole Guru Sisha, the whole Upanishads are all to do with this Guru Sisha relationship where, you know, the teacher who's gained knowledge from his or her teacher, you know, passes that on to the student. Because you see, from the standpoint of your mind and sense organs, and your individuality here, this body, mind, sensory, how is the mind going to know? How is it going to perform that differentiation? Because of all of its means of knowledge go out into the world. And so there's certain epistemological limits there. Like the mind could even have a samadhi experience where it just experiences pure awareness, but then when it comes back from it, it says, oh, I had this experience of pure awareness. Now, and so if the ahankara, the I notion, stays with the mind that had this experience, then I wish I could have it again.
Yeah.
You know? Or I wish I could have it for longer. If the I still stays with the mind, and then this ego mind wants to have more experiences and to evolve and to become a really, you know, a yogi who is able to maintain these samadhi experiences for long periods of time. But the ahankara is still with the pot.
But to interact in the world, they're still using
all of
water.
It. Yeah. It's not like you gain knowledge and all of a sudden the world disappears. It doesn't disappear until the body drops.
But then the awareness we have of the body and the interaction with the world, is that not true then? Or is it true?
Now, tell me again. I missed one piece there.
Okay. The awareness we have of the body, and then the awareness with which we interact with the world. Is that true? And
the awareness is true.
Okay.
But you're thinking that the awareness that you experience is limited to the body. The mind's thinking that it belongs to the body and mind.
Okay.
That's what's not true. The awareness is very true. And the awareness is the constant. You can never change it or get rid of yourself. If you can get rid of it, it's not you. That's a good meditation. Whatever you can get rid of is not you. Whatever you can be without experientially is not you. So that's just going to leave you with you, you know.
So what is it that directs awareness, you know, that has the intentional relationship with objects? It's the mind.
That's the mind. And if you want to go a little farther than that, we would say, well, I mean, that's the right answer. But I was going to go into more prarabdha. Mm-hmm. The very karmas that bring you into this life have a certain subtle likes and dislikes that take you through the whole life. The prarabdha, the karma that takes you through the whole life, really plays a major part in directing the course of your life,
mm-hmm.
which is says something about your interests. You know, like to go outside of your prarabdha, you can for a while, but you'll kind of get pulled back into your the mainstream of your life,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to involve your interest. Why are you interested in this and not something else?
And do you have control over those interests, or do they just...
Well, you can also pick up interests, but they won't... If they're interests that you're picking up along the way that aren't in line with your prarabdha, but you see because the Joneses over here are doing it, you know, they don't have a longevity.
Mm.
You know? Mm. Because the prarabdha itself isn't that supportive.
Mm.
You can... You may even talk about this in the Gita. Like, say, somebody else seems to be doing something that's interesting. Even if you see it on television or whatever, you know, and you kind of get a hankering for that, and then you start thinking about it a lot in a lot of different ways, and you read books about it, and your mind can build up a whole, what we call, pratibhasika reality. You know, there's this vyavahara, this is Ishvara's reality, this physical reality that you find yourself in and the course of your life that is going from birth to death. But within this life, you've picked up a desire and tended it. So all you're talking about is you tend it. You know, he uses this kind of an example where this woman is walking down the street in Indian Delhi or somewhere, and she goes by a sari shop. And so she's walking, she sees this beautiful sari, and she just says, oh, that's a nice sari. And then she keeps walking, you know. But as she gets a couple of blocks, she starts thinking, I really did like that sari. That was a beautiful color. It looked like it was silk. Yeah. And so the next day on her way to work, she looks and notices it again. And then she starts thinking, you know, I do have to go to, we're all going to go to this party next week. It would be really nice to have that sari. And then she starts imagining, I wonder how much that, anyway, she builds up a, but you can see yourself doing this, right, with whatever the object may be. And then you start building like an imaginary world around this object. Depending, like, the object could be a new house, it could be anything.
Mm.
You know, and then you start tending it, and your mind gets involved. It's pretty pratibhasika. It's like you're creating an imaginal world. And then you want, it's all desire. It's a web of desire. You know, and then if that imaginal world that you've created actually has some roots in your karma, then it'll come to pass and you'll feel so happy about it. And if it has no roots in your karma, you know, the karma just rips right through it. You know, and it doesn't happen. So kind of knowing, understanding that as just a little piece of information can be useful to watch your mind building up on how the mind can build up on a desire that was triggered by something, you know. And those things usually fall off. But the real desires that really belong to you, those are in some ways almost unnoticeable because they're continuing to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that it's a desire that is manifesting in the form of your immediate reality, you know. And an interesting thing to look at with that is when you are in this situation, whatever it may be, and you can ask yourself, do you really want to be out of the situation, you know? And you can say, oh yes, I definitely want to be out of it. But when you make efforts to push yourself out of it, then you usually want to get back into it. Because you're pushing yourself out off the edge of your prarabdha. In order for you to make sense of these words, you have to kind of look at your own experience and see how they fit. But it's fun to do it, you know. You have a comfort level and a belonging in relationship to where you are. Even when it's good and bad, that's not the point. It's that it's yours. I guess, you know, it's yours.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a comfort level to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when that comfort level, that level I'm talking about, goes, you will also go. You know, because you're going to be moved along with your prarabdha. That comfort level of you being situated is changing its place.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we stop.